I've got on here.
Hey, we're here. Excellent. Okay, everybody, welcome to Read Science. What's our byline, Jeff? Say that again.
Let's see, all about what? Science writing, science writers, and science written for non-scientists, or something similar
something
to that.
Something like that, yeah. So anyway, so we are here today with two authors who are not afraid to tackle the topic of poop or sanitation and how the world gets rid of it or not. And I'm Joanne, and my co-host is Jeff, and I would like to introduce, first of all, my friend Scott Hewler. I have his latest book right here. Oh, it's the advanced copy that you handed to me the first time we met in person, Scott. He just pulled it out of his bag. He goes, oh, great. You look like a great person who needs this book. So his book is On the Grid. But you've written more books than this, and you've written, like 6 books? And I would say 2 of them seem to have a science theme. So the On the Grid is this look at a town and the things we take for granted, like electricity and clean water and how we get rid of dirty water. And it's a very enjoyable, very accessible book. You also write for the New York Times and articles all over the place. So your other strongly scientific book is Defining the Wind, which is about the Beaufort Scale, which I know Jeff is a huge fan of.
Absolutely my favorite, yeah.
Great. Well, I'm glad to be here. It's
good. Why don't you introduce Rose?
Yes, it's my pleasure. Here we have Rose George, and I was just learning from her website this morning that she's been writing for almost 20 years, which is a pretty incredible career, and that a good part of that, she's been a freelance author with all sorts of big-name periodicals, newspapers, and everything that you would care to read, that you have 2 books so far, one called A Life Removed, Hunting for Refuge in the Modern World, and then the one that is closer to our topic today, The Big Necessity, Adventures in the World of Human Waste. And I have about 12 more pages to finish in that, and that's going very well. Rose identifies as a journalist. And if you ask me, I would say that she seems drawn to writing about big social issues, but with what I would say approvingly as high scienticity from her viewpoint. And if I'm correct, are you joining us from London today?
No, I'm actually in Leeds, which is in the north of England.
We are very cosmopolitan today. Thank you, Rose, for being with us.
You're welcome.
That's right. Scott's over in North Carolina.
Right. Where we celebrate science in all ways in North Carolina.
Well, you do, though. Isn't it true that there's a large density of science bloggers in North Carolina?
North Carolina is a tremendously scientific place. We host Science Online every year, of course, a tremendous conference, and we have Duke University and the University of North Carolina and all kinds of things like that. We also have an insane legislation, and I don't even know how to respond to that.
Yeah, something that does not reflect science very well at all. But,
fortunately, they do have those crazies there, but fortunately Scott is there to keep an eye on them and let everybody know what's going on.
Right. Right, I have a cottage industry in writing about North Carolina legislative anti-science madness, and it's been a great satisfaction of my career.
So how this whole hangout came about was because I got invited to go to India with the International Reporting Project, which is through Johns Hopkins, and the Bill Gates Foundation funds that. And we were looking at issues of child survival. And what are the major issues of child survival? Of course, there's vaccination and childhood disease and sanitation and maternal fetal health. Well, they're all linked, and it's a web of issues that just cannot be separated, really. And I ended up thinking, well, I want to write a post at my Joanne Loves Science about sanitation. And I didn't know quite where to start. So what I did was I actually contacted Scott. And Scott said, well, the first thing is that, there was British Medical Journal, Journal of Medicine, that asked doctors, what was the biggest improvement in health? How did that come about? And they all, it was sanitation, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what are some good resources? And he pointed me to a few, and he pointed me to Rose's book, The Big Necessity, which then I devoured before I went to India. And then I shortly after returned from India, here's Rose on TED giving this fabulous TED Talk. Exactly what was the title, Rose? Do you remember the title? It was some Let's Talk Shit or something.
Yeah. So I just have to say, you keep cutting out. So if I'm having to kind of guess at words. Okay. So that may not make sense.
Okay.
But I got the Let's Talk Shit. So that's the important bit.
If you could just share the title of your TED Talk.
Oh, I think, well, it's TED's title, and it was Let's Talk Crap. What was it? Let's Talk Crap Seriously, was it? I think something like that. Which is funny, because I don't actually use the word crap in the TED Talk, but I think that's the word they came up with, because it's language is a consideration when you talk about, when you start talking about sanitation and sewage and shit and poop and feces and excrement and caca, and I could go on. So I think it was Let's Talk Crap Seriously, which is what science should do.
Well, and so you've gotten there, and I'm fresh from almost finishing reading The Big Necessity, and I hate to hate to be cliched, but what an eye opener. And yeah, this can lead into the whole topic that I had in mind of how poor humans, or Americans, I think humans, are at relative risk assessment, because shit is a bigger problem and what to do with it than, you know, terrorist bombs and dying in plane crashes, and nobody notices it or thinks about it, mm-hmm, except for sanitation engineers. Thanks to Scott for heralding those.
Well, I'll point out, Jeff, I just, in fact, gave a TEDx talk a couple weeks ago, and
you should mention the detail, because I listened to it yesterday, and yeah, that's where I got that you said, you know, all of these things, somebody has thought about them, and this is a great thing, but we don't think about those engineers either.
Right. Well, but you're talking about money. The American Society of Civil Engineers puts the American infrastructure system about $3.5 trillion behind in investment and repair. Mm. And it's very interesting. You were talking about how terrible we are at risk assessment. We have spent almost exactly that $3.5 trillion in the last 10 years going to Asia and blowing people up, because we're terrified about somebody doing something bad to us, but we're ignoring the fact that if we don't maintain this infrastructure, something terrible is going to happen, but we're doing it to ourselves all day, every day.
Yeah, and we worry about terrorist bombs all the time, when it's probably more likely that we're going to suffer cholera and die from diarrhea, as so many people do around the world, an amazing number.
I think that the trouble is, and I think this translates both to developing and developed world situations, and is that the problems are often discrete, as in discrete. So they happen to like in the US or in the UK, people have sewage backups in their yard or in their basement or whatever, but it's only ever one household, and it never becomes a mass. And so it's the same with diarrhea in the developing world, that it's always just one kid here, one kid there. It's not often, it's never kind of a mass crisis.
You make me wonder whether we know that we don't pay it enough attention, and it's always hard to keep everything in sight that we should. But do we just overlook it with a lack of awareness, or do we ignore it from feelings of denial and we'd rather not deal with it?
I think both. I mean, people often ask me, why don't we talk about the toilet? Why don't we talk about the bathroom? Why don't we talk about sewers? Well, obviously sewers are underground. They're difficult to get to. They're dangerous. But I think also that, I mean, it's kind of a trite answer, but I think that when we made this wonderful waste disposal unit, which is the flush toilet, and we put it behind a closed door, and we developed this thing called individual privacy, I think then we were given permission to ignore it in a way. It was easy to ignore it. It's kind of a general view, but that's usually my answer.
A quick one, but do you have to disabuse first world people that you talk to and explain that most of the people don't have water flow and toilet sanitation that we take for granted?
Yes, and it's astonishing because it's often people who travel. So it's really astonishing how much of us have this thing called, which I think Erwin Goffman calls civil inattention, which is what we all have. We need that to walk down a crowded street. You can't be overwhelmed by the mass of people that we're cohabiting this planet with. And I think that we have to ignore certain things. I think it's wrong, but I think mm-hmm. it's kind of a survival mechanism. But I think there's a really interesting art project which Scott will probably really like, which is about how infrastructure is so necessary and all the people who work on this infrastructure. I don't know about in the US, but in the UK they wear something called high vis. So it's high visibility, you know, the neon jackets. Yeah,
right.
Those orange vests. And this artist friend of mine, Stephen Gill, did this wonderful book called Invisible, and his point, which I think was amazing, was that this thing that was invented to be visible has become invisible. So there's no better way to hide in a crowded street than to wear a high visibility vest and to pretend that you're fixing our essential infrastructure.
Rose, that is wonderful. I would love you to send a link to something about that. I would love to find a way to look at that and probably blog about it. So send it to me if you can.
Sure. Yeah.
But one of the things that I always tell people when I'm talking about sewage, which I do a lot, is that 3/4 of our sewage infrastructure is underground. You can tell people, mm-hmm. you can get people sexed up about a water plant or even a wastewater treatment plant, but 3/4 of the investment that we have in wastewater treatment and water infrastructure is pipes underground. There's just no way you're going to get people excited about, oh boy, here's what we're doing, is digging a hole and putting a pipe in. They lack the capacity for that kind of attention and self-awareness.
Yeah, or they just get angry about it because it's digging up their street.
Right, there's a backhoe and I have to go a different way to work, and you bastards, mm-hmm. and you know, plus my sewer's backing up. You know, I don't even know how you deal with these people.
It's true, and yet if you do go down sewers, I mean, I'm sure, Scott, did you go down the sewers in Raleigh?
Well, I went, you know, we have separate systems, Rose. We have, we're such a new city that we have sanitary sewers and we have stormwater sewers. Mm. And so I've taken people down, I've led tours, as Joanne knows, I have led tours through our stormwater sewers. And it's wonderful, and people are very interested in it, but that makes it even less likely that you're going to be aware of what's going on in the sanitary sewers in a place like Raleigh. And we, Raleigh, the city decided to ban garbage disposals at one point with the idea that keeping food waste and grease out of the sewers would prevent sewage backups, prevent wastewater backups. And the people went apeshit. The people they couldn't imagine why they would have to give up something that was convenient to them. Trying to make the connection to them that the grease that you pour down your drain eventually causes a civic problem, mm-hmm. they just didn't even want to hear it. That's my personal space, my sink. I can put anything down it that I want to. So,
and it's an expensive civil problem, too.
I think the difficulty is that it's an on-site issue, and then there's this public infrastructure. So you're having this kind of clash between, as Scott says, to someone, it's my sink, but it's a public sewer, or it's a local sewer leading into a public sewer. So you've got this kind of disparity between, ownership and rights and not much responsibility. I mean, I really feel for wastewater treatment managers, the kind of shit that goes down sewers. I don't mean shit. But, you know, they have to deal with all sorts, not just the fat and the oils and the grease, which is, I mean, I've walked nearly face first into a big block of fat that was blocking a stairwell in a sewer in London. And the flushers, the wastewater treatment, the sewer guys, they absolutely hate it. They hate it much more than shit, because it's so difficult to remove, it's so expensive, and it gets in their skin, and they can't get rid of it. They don't mind shit.
Right. Shit washes out, exactly.
Yeah.
And it's hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
Maybe we need more movies like The Third Man. I wanted to thank you, Rose, for mentioning Harry Lime just at the moment we were starting to tour the sewers, And I started thinking, flashing on poor Harry Lime trying to get away, and you said it, and I thought, well, that was really lovely. I appreciated that.
I think the problem is obviously that, as Scott says, 3/4 of, you know, wastewater infrastructure is underground. We can't see it, but if we could see it, I think more people would be really fascinated. But you have security issues, you have public health issues. But I do think that the industry as a whole has been very conservative and very reluctant to publicise what they do because they sort of assume that we're all going to be disgusted by it, whereas in fact, it's my experience that over the past 5-6 years that I've been writing about shit and toilets, that I've only about 6 people have changed the subject. Mm. And in fact, what routinely happens is that they'll get, what are you writing about? And I'll say toilets or shit or whatever. And they'll say, and there'll be a pause, and then they'll say, oh, I have a great story about a toilet, and then I don't have to say another word for like the next half an hour. So I don't think it's true that we're not interested or we're disgusted. I think there's this assumption, and I think that operates in NGOs who are afraid to campaign for sanitation because they don't want to feature latrines or ask for money for latrines. I think it's true of wastewater infrastructure people who are not lobbying, who are not making a public case. And I think it's a bit old-fashioned, really. I think you get over it.
I made a note in my book about the vast differences between American cultural response to anything toilet and the Japanese, and you know that could start shift. And then there's Americans, there's Japanese, and then there's India. And so you know, I want to hear you and Joanne talk about visiting India. And Joanne,
Scott's been in India too.
Yeah, and Scott, I mean, are you given the sanitary tour? Did you see some of these things that Rose talked about? And I had no idea that there was so much a problem with open defecation, getting people to use toilets. It's hard to come up with toilets, making latrines programs that are hard to get going because they can build 10,000 latrines and that's still 1/1,000,000th of the problem that they need to solve. It's amazing, but a lot of interesting stuff to talk about too.
Yeah, so we were touring slums and resettlements and things like that. So they weren't trying to hide and give us the polished view of India. And actually, that might have been nicer to see more of the polished view of India. And what I liked was, in Rose's TED Talk, she really encapsulated the issues. It's like, even if there are toilets, there are reasons people don't use toilets. And a lot has to do with safety. Especially of women and girls, and they will have to wait, or they don't want to pay the small little fee, which a small little fee is a lot to some of these people who earn hardly anything. And the issue with the girls in schools, and I think I'll actually let Rose expand on that, as she did a great job in her TED Talk, but this is a huge issue. This is, it's just major.
It's absolutely enormous, and it's just astonishing that the link between education and sanitation has really only been over the last 5 or 6 years. And, the simple issue is that girls, particularly when they start menstruating, they're often going to schools that have got no latrines. This is true across many developing countries like India, but also across Africa, Asia, all sorts. Or they've got horrible latrines. I mean, I don't know, Joanne, if you saw any, but every single school I visited in India nearly has horrible latrines. And then they start menstruating, they've got nowhere to change, they don't have clean pads, they're terrified that they're smelling, they're worried that other kids are going to take the mickey out of them. And so what happens is they start dropping out of school, and it's usually 4 or 5 days a month, and then eventually they drop out permanently. And there's been a study in India which found that 23% of girls drop out of school when they start menstruating, when they hit puberty. I mean, that is enormous. Any educationist or anyone interested in improving education, that is a dramatic dropout rate. And if you know that you can solve that dropout rate and get those girls back in school, which of course has knock-on effects in development, in income generation, in all sorts of knock-on effects, in health, it's really baffling that it hasn't been done before. But the good news is that I think those connections are being made. And I went to a meeting recently at the UN, the Water Supply and Sanitation Collaborative Council, hell of a mouthful, really good UN agency, terrible name. we had this meeting on menstrual hygiene management, and the great thing was that in the room were lots of people from education, from health, businesses who lose their workers 6 days a month, because there's a lot of the businesses in like Pakistan and Bangladesh, garment factories, the workers are women, and they don't want to come into work, so they don't know how to handle it, and it's because they don't have clean, they don't have toilets or latrines or sanitation. So it has all these knock-on effects. It's also linked to malnutrition, it's also linked to stunting, it's also linked to reduction of IQ. All these things are now sort of coming together, but you know, sanitation just cuts across every single area of development. But that's, I think these are quite exciting times that people are making those connections.
It's really interesting. So you brought about malnutrition, and it leads to mortality, particularly for children under five, and particularly for infants, because that the things we're used to, we've been sort of indoctrinated that you wash your hands after you do this and before you go make food and do this. You know, that people, and then they're also drinking from the very water that they're soiling. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then you're left with diarrhea at the very least, so some maybe dysentery or cholera or something that, you know, prevents absorption of nutrients, or you don't feel like eating because you're sick. But also there's a more complex, even if you're not getting sick, your internal flora, microflora, is very imbalanced because you're continually taking in this microflora that you're not meant to be absorbing, and that has been shown. It's called enteropathy, environmental enteropathy, and you're actually unable to absorb your nutrients properly because you're not, your bacteria, they aren't the right ones to do that. And so we see this malnutrition. And I do recall this one thing. I thought, this lady sitting there with a kid on the lap, and I thought, gosh, well, that looks like a perfectly healthy 9-month-old. And actually the kid was like 2.5. And I went, oh. So, you know, it was a bit of a surprise to me because I, you know, I thought, well, that kid looks just fine. What are they talking about? And then when I asked her, I was like, oh, okay. Well, all right.
I mean,
a 2-year-old I know.
the death toll is just ridiculous from diarrhea. I mean, it's, you know, one child every 15 seconds. But if you look, it's such a disparity between the death toll and the focus given to it. I mean, even when there's a massive outbreak, as in Haiti, I mean, I think the figures are about 3,000 people now have died of cholera. But I don't know if it's had more attention in the US, but it's had barely any coverage over here.
Is that still attributed to being an act of God? Well, it's one of those things, you know, nature, they get sick, they die, we can't do anything about it. Poor people, they're poor.
Well, what I have read about it is that it was an act of the United Nations, actually. It was attributed to a Nepali battalion who came over and were emptying their cesspits or latrines into a river where other people were taking drinking water from. Mm. So I think I have seen that written about. I suppose I should say that. I don't think the UN does deny that, but it's been pretty substantively asserted anyway. So I don't know what it is. What do you think, Scott? Why don't we look at this thing?
Well, I haven't been able to figure out, because my experience, Rose, is very much like yours, that when you're at a party and somebody says, well, what are you working on? And for me, it's a broader topic. It's just infrastructure in general. People put down what they're eating and drinking and want to talk to you, that you engage, because you're waking them up. You're saying, hey, you know what? Look up there, all those wires. You know what that is? That's the grid. The grid. We talk about it. But it actually exists. It occupies space. It has weight. It's a real thing, and you can understand it if you apply your conscious thought to it. And people, they vibrate. They're so excited to learn about the world around them, and that they're somehow encouraged. I think, like, something in our educational system must teach them that if it's not a formula on a page or a fact to be regurgitated, they shouldn't really know about it and shouldn't really follow about it.
Now that you're into infrastructure, and it's like the big personal thing that came to me is that one of the formative things that I read and saw, and this is from the late 70s, and then I read the book later, was James Burke's Connections.
Right.
And if you know that, then you know fabulous and all of the things he did. And the first program he started out with, and his thesis was to show how various ideas lead to other ideas, and not in a unique way that is history, but in one way that you can tell a story about history that's useful, and there are many stories. One of the big stories he wanted to tell was about this relay that he was dramatically holding in his hand that was the basic cause of the 1969 power outage in New York City that was so devastating. And his big question there was, and we hear this from a lot of corners even today, people say, well, I've got my gun. If the power goes off and civilization breaks down, I'll go out and shoot the farmer and start living off the land. And he's saying, do you know when to plant those seeds? Do you know how to plow the land? Do you know when to water it? Do you know what harvesting looks like? You can't live without these things. You don't any longer have that knowledge because you've lived so far for so long away from the land that you can't do it. And this is what you talk about is you can't live without these things now.
Well, I tell people that we are like children. We cannot eat, drink, or go to the bathroom without help. And it's reality, and that's fine. I have no objection to that. I just think that since we're aware of that, we should be paying the hell out of the engineers. We should be taking incredible care of these systems that enable us to eat, drink, and go to the bathroom. And so, you know, Rose, it's not, I don't think you have the same problems that we have in this absolutely like hellish response to taxation. The people in the United States were the, I think, third least tax of the like 35 Western advanced democracies. We are like number 32 or something like that. Mm-hmm. And the United States population thinks that we're overtaxed. Mm-hmm. So the disconnect between reality and perception is, I haven't been able to overcome it at all, and no matter how much I talk about it, and I talk about it a lot, I'm actively, you know, begging for higher taxes and greater investment, and people laugh at me.
But aren't you addressing this problem partly or indirectly? Because surely part of thinking that we're overtaxed is having no realization of the many vital things that we're actually paying for by paying taxes.
Right. Oh, absolutely. That's a, and as you say, people, the wastewater treatment manager that I interviewed for the city of Raleigh when I was doing the book about infrastructure, he just worried. He sat and talked to me because he said, if these systems come apart, and, mm-hmm. you know, given our level of investment, they probably will, he said, these people, they couldn't go out and shoot him a squirrel and cook it for dinner. They wouldn't know how to do that. And he said they wouldn't know how to dig a hole for an outhouse and pick up the outhouse and put it on top of the hole and then take the dirt from this year's hole and put it into last year's hole. They don't understand that. They wouldn't know how to keep the outhouse in an area of lesser hydrological pressure from where their well is. Mm-hmm. Make it downhill, just downhill isn't enough because the well goes deep, and even if even if it's lower than the well, if the hydrological pressure is pushing the water up, it can still get into the well. People mm-hmm. don't understand any of these things. They don't know it, and they're not, you know, I hate to get all Rumsfeld on your butts here, but these are unknown unknowns, right? Yeah. See, terrorism seems to be a known unknown. We know that we should be afraid of those brown people who may come and blow us up, but something like, you know, sanitation, people don't understand because it's like, I flush the toilet, that stuff goes away. So what do you mean we have to invest in it?
At best, there's a cartoon theory of survivalism that, you know, we see enough images perhaps and stories of people who are in the breakdown of civilization, and so they go off and they shoot animals and they do them and life is happy and things. And as you say, that's an unknown unknown. It really doesn't work like that.
Right, and exactly this cartoon belief that people have that they could just get along without this stuff. There's a book came out at the same time I wrote on the Grid that was called Off the Grid by Rose. You've probably run across the author of that, and he's very much, he was disgusted with me. He called me a cheerleader for, you know, like the oil companies and the power companies. And I said, no, I wouldn't say that by any means. But I certainly think that we like these systems and we'd hate it trying to get along without them. And
well, we know that people have lived without them in the past, but it was a different time, people were different, and very significantly, there were a lot fewer people.
And also, right. it wasn't actually very successful. I mean, if you look at London in the 19th century, you can't say, of course, people have more skills at maybe, I don't know, skinning squirrels or whatever, but but there was cholera every 10 years, regular as the rain. People, as soon as you get people living in close quarters in those numbers, you have to have some kind of mass waste treatment or disposal or some kind of management. But I mean, Scott, going back to what you said about taxes, I mean, we have our own tax arguments here, but what baffles me is when people object to paying 50 cents more a year on their water bill.
Right.
And you get these people writing in some of our newspapers saying, but it should be free. Water's free. Well,
right.
Okay, you know, go and catch it.
just go take your cup down to the Thames and take a drink. And then that's how you'll get your water, and we'll see. We'll do a study at the end of a month. We'll see who's happier, you or me. You know,
yeah.
I don't know. I think Rose, you and I should just be in charge, and we should get to make the rules.
And one of the things that people ask me a lot is, well, what can we? You know, when I say that, when we're talking about wastewater and infrastructure, and they say, well, what can we do? How can we make things better? And I'm so well. I honestly don't know. Of course, we need to fund it, but it's not going to get $3.3 trillion. It's not in the UK or the US. We should ideally retrofit them so we have separate systems everywhere, mm-hmm. because these combined systems that take stormwater mm-hmm. and everything that goes into the sewer system, they're just overloaded to the point of crisis. But that's not going to happen. So what on earth do we do? And I always feel really inadequate when people ask me, because what do I say? You know, go and build your own composting toilet. Okay, well, that's great. What if you live in a city centre apartment?
Right.
What do? You just flush less, try not to put fat down the toilet, you know, pay your water bill without complaining. But I don't know what else to say. Do you have some magic answer for them, Scott?
No, in fact, one of the economists that I spoke to about infrastructure said the horrific truth is that if you want to build infrastructure, go someplace where they don't have it,
yeah.
because they want it so badly, and they
yeah.
will pay whatever it costs. Because, you know, when I would talk to this guy who wrote Off the Grid, who was telling me that, you know, that sewage treatment plants were basically a Ponzi scheme or something like that. And I was saying, you know, there are 2 billion people on this planet. You don't even have to leave Earth before you could find 2 billion people who would probably sacrifice a limb to have access to what we take for granted.
But that wouldn't necessarily be the best thing for their particular environment. That's the problem.
Right, exactly.
So Rose is not convinced me that everybody in India is looking for toilets.
Well, that's not true. I mean, because there are certain parts. I do want to read from Sunita Narain. She put a commentary in Nature, and she's an environmentalist in India. And so she says, the challenge for science is to look beyond the modern engineering mindset. We know that current technologies, which use large amounts of clean water to transport small amounts of excreta through expensive pipes to costly treatment plants, are unworkable and unaffordable in much of the world. So this is echoing what Rose has said. Yet toilets and sewage disposal are among the least researched technologies. And I'd like you guys to comment on that, because Rose would be in a place mm-hmm. to comment. And then it says, new technologies and new thinking are urgently needed for use across diverse ecosystems. Open drains might become planted waterways with vegetation cleansing the water, or microbes mm-hmm. might be used to decompose and depathogenize effluent. Sewage must be treated as a resource, turned into water for drinking, irrigation, or industry. So this was a gal who last summer coined this, you know, she says, India is drowning in its own excreta. And this
did she say excreta or did she say shit?
well, I don't know, actually, but I think in nature it says excreta or excreta.
Yeah, it probably one is. Thing.
So in nature, yeah. She didn't say shit. but so all of that, I'd like you to comment on any part of that. I thought that's interesting. That's like, oh, is it really true that we haven't looked into other options?
Well, I think over sort of the last 40, 50 years, let's take India in particular. So since independence, there has been a mindset amongst certain donors and certain donor governments that what we need to do is transfer our model and our paradigm, lock, stock and barrel, to every developing country. So obviously, you now go to India or very many developing countries and you find these wastewater treatment plants which look okay, and then you'll find that there isn't the money for the upkeep, and they're discharging raw sewage straight into the river. So the Yamuna River now that comes through Delhi, down from the Himalayas, is dead because it's had too much runoff and sewage overload. Well, the Ganges, you know, it purifies you, but probably not in a way you want it to because there's so much sewage in it. And you've just got all these kind of, not redundant plants, but really imperfect wastewater treatment. And I think now, again, I think over the last 10, 15 years, things are changing, and there's an idea that there's this thing called the sanitation ladder, and at the top of the ladder you have the flush toilet and the wastewater treatment and the sewer system and da-da. And that was always thought of as the epitome of good sanitation that should be transplanted all over the world. That was development. And I think there is much more now a sense of flexibility, and what Sunita's saying is that you have to look at the context. So obviously you can't go and put in a wastewater treatment plant in a slum, because for a start, or any kind of informal settlement as they're known, and they're huge, huge cities, you know, these slum cities, I'm sure you went to them, Jan. Yeah. But you can't do that because the authorities don't want to give anybody any sense that they've got any land rights or any right to be there. They're often, they're squatting, a lot of them. So they don't want to put in sewers or wastewater treatment. So that people are having to look, because there are so many slums now and they're growing so rapidly, that they're having to look at other solutions. And other solutions may be community toilets. They may be shallower sewers. They've done that in Orangi in Pakistan, where the leader of that project was horribly and horrifically murdered recently. Very, very sad. But she was known for this Orangi pilot project in a slum in Pakistan. They've done it in Brazil as well. So I think there is innovation. And of course, there's the Gates Foundation. They're now doing the Reinvent the Toilet. And they've thrown a lot of money at this to try and get innovation, to get a low-cost, sustainable system that can be flexible. And I think that's pretty exciting, actually. That's just over the last couple of years. So I think things are changing pretty rapidly. And there's it's more sophisticated thinking now. It's not just, you know, let's just take a treatment plant and stick it in Delhi or wherever, or, you know.
Well, I agree with that completely, Rose. And one of the things that I saw here at NC State, there's a graduate student who's gotten a wonderful grant, because what he figured out is that the biggest problem that he was finding, you guys would know more about this, is that people are pretty good at knowing to dig a latrine and build one, but then it fills, and then what? And,
yeah, exactly.
And what he figured out is that the Archimedes screw is the simplest technology, and we've had it for 3,000 years or 2,500 years, and that he figured out a way to get to these communities, give them Archimedes screws that would raise the water into tanks, then they could take the tank somewhere and safely dispose of it, use it as, you know, fertilizer and things like that. They can't do what, you know, the city of Raleigh, for example, does a great job. I think 90% of its, the solids from its sewage treatment plant are reapplied to the land and are used as fertilizer. It's fabulous. It's wonderful that they, and you know, they talk about the water use, for example, which I'll get to in a second, but this something simple, the solutions, I think Rose and Joanne, you guys have seen it much better than I have, but I have been really convinced that the solutions are simple solutions, not these large Western hugely engineered projects, which I don't object to here because they fit our cities and we have the money to pay for them, and our lack of maintenance of them is a choice, not a problem. It's not something, it's not that we can't maintain them, it's that
yeah, it's not inevitable. Yeah.
And so we could maintain them if we wanted. But in other places, where they're starting from scratch, you want to start with much smaller systems that you can maintain, because I think that when you've got 10 families depending on the latrine, those families are going to find a way to clean it up. Mm-hmm. If they have the capacity to clean it up, they're much more likely to use their labor and their time and then their money to clean it up if they can manage it well and they understand what's happening.
It's true. And there is a school of thought in India, because there's so much wonderful sanitation activism going on in India. There's so much shit lying around on the one hand, but on the other hand, there are all these wonderful people trying to solve the problem. And I mean, some of this technology does not have to be complicated. And there is a school of thought that says that you can have the most basic latrine. What you have to do is change the psychology first. It's what you were mentioning earlier, Joanne, is you have to make people want to use a toilet, because sometimes mm-hmm. they're used to using the open defecation grounds. They might be next to a nice flowing river. They don't have any concept of polluting someone else's downstream water. But you have to make them want a latrine, and then it doesn't matter if it's just a pit in a ground, because that at least is containment. Right. And then what people have found is that people will actually upgrade. So there was this project outside Calcutta where they provided this very, very low-cost latrine slab, and nobody chose it. They chose the one that was a few hundred rupees more expensive, because they wanted people, people don't realize that poor people aspire to having nice mm-hmm. stuff as well. I mean, the other aspect is that I've met plenty of kids in slums who say, no, 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 we haven't got a toilet, and then they show me their smartphone. So, it's a question of priorities as well. But I do think there's some great low-cost technologies. You can have something called an arbaloo, where you plant a tree in a latrine. You can, if you've got enough land, of course. There's all sorts of high-tech technologies that are sort of microwave toilets and interesting composting toilets, and I think there is a lot of thought and innovation in sanitation. It's just that it tends to be small scale pilot projects, mm-hmm. and there's never going to be some kind of huge systemic magic bullet solution to sanitation. It has to be this kind of widespread innovation and flexibility, I think.
I think I might guess what Scott's answer will be, but what is it going to take to turn waste into a resource?
Well, I think it's happening now. I honestly do. I'll use Raleigh as an example. Like I said, almost all of the solids collected in the wastewater mm-hmm. treatment process are reapplied to the soil and used as fertilizer. It's a great thing. The farmers love it. The city supplies it for free, takes it. As long as the farmers are willing to follow programs and learn how to use it, the city will apply it, and it's great. You know, there are laws, you can only use it for fodder for animals, you can't grow mm-hmm. food that humans will mm-hmm. eat and stuff like that, but it's a great product and it works. And the city uses a lot of the liquids, a lot of the effluent from the wastewater treatment plant, which is cleaner than the river that it was taken out from in the first place, mm-hmm. and they use it for irrigation and stuff like that. They sell it to golf courses, and they have special pipes and stuff like that. So one of the things that I wanted to point out about the quote, Joanne, that you read about this waste of water is that's when you're dealing with a modern city, that's less clear. Yeah, a flush toilet is definitely a luxury, but you know, Raleigh takes 40 million gallons or so, between 40 and 50 million gallons a day from the Neuse River, and mm-hmm. pumps back out into the Neuse River from the wastewater treatment plant 40 or 50 million gallons a day. So it's going a different direction, but then it the same water goes right back to the same river, and it's actually cleaner than when we got it. So, and, 90% of that water, 95% of that water is used for showering, for stuff like that. So I agree we could do better with toilets, but I'm not sure in a Western city the water is really that much of an issue for sanitation, because the water is either being reused or, maybe several times through the cycle, or it's going right back into the river that it came out of in the first place.
That's true, Scott, but I think two things. One is that all water is recycled sewage at some point. So
right,
you know, it has to be, which is something that when you get these people objecting and talking about toilet to tap, oh my God. And it's like, well, where do you think it comes from? It's just, but the other thing is that, okay, none of the water is wasted as such. It doesn't disappear, but it is expensive to clean. And wastewater treatment, modern wastewater treatment, is energy intensive. Mm-hmm. And I think waste, you know, let's stop calling it waste and let's call it a resource. I mean, biosolids, as they're known, these sewage solids that are used, that's been going on for decades. And we use it all the time. It's just that they've never really talked about it. And right. And if you look back to the 19th century, there were sewage farms. There was, you know, a really famous one in Pasadena, California. In the past, we've treated this stuff as the resource that it is. And I just think how odd that we've decided to stop looking at it as a resource. But I think the other thing which you probably know more about, Scott, is using the methane and generating electricity, which over in the UK, Thames Water has now, they sent out a press release a couple of years ago saying, we are now getting £15 million a year that we are generating our own electricity and we are selling it back to the national grid. And I read that and I thought, well, why weren't you doing that before?
Right.
You've got all this methane, which is generally flared off, you know, just burnt off wastefully. And I think it, I don't know if you agree, Scott, but I think it comes down to something as prosaic as like a budget cycle, as the length of a budget. And so maybe that nobody, and particularly I think in the US you have more elected officials involved in these kinds of decisions. So you have people who are worried about the voting cycle and they don't want to pay for maybe a capital intensive project that's going to take more than 5 or 6 years to pay off. And so these things just don't get put in.
Yeah, I agree 100%, Rose, that there's, I think it's anaerobic digestion generates the methane, that there are a lot of newer sewage treatment plants that are being built that never have to connect to the grid. They just make their own electricity out of the methane generated by the, you know, as you say, waste, by the resource that we all recognize is an actual resource, whether it's fertilizer or energy or any number of things. Now, Raleigh, for example, was really looking into that and realized that it was just going to cost too much and that we've got this investment in this $70 million a day, million gallons a day treatment capacity wastewater treatment plant, to rebuild it was going to be so expensive that I thought we're just going to stick with biosolids and stick with water reuse rather than starting to do that. But I think that every place should be looking at that. I think, Rose, that's exactly right. It is not, and it hasn't been going on for decades. It's been going on for millennia. You know, the Romans collected the ammonia from urine and used it for what we would call dry cleaning. And they collected, you know, they've been collecting what we would call night soil since the dawn of time and using it.
And the Chinese still do.
Right. It's only, as you say, it's only in about the last 100 or 150 years where we suddenly thought that we were too good to touch this stuff.
I mean, my grandmother remembers the man who came around and collected the urine that they used in the tanning industries and the leather industries. It's still in living memory.
For some reason,
now we have this luxury of being able to flush and forget, and that's We're wasting a hell of a lot.
Right.
Hey fellas and gals. I'm like looking at the time going, ooh, we're almost up for an hour. And I know, Rose, you have to move on.
I do. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I do want to make sure, though, that we absolutely mention that you have a new book coming out this summer.
I do. Let me show you the...
Yes, tell us a little bit about that. And I'm so glad that you actually brought up, between Jeff and Scott here, this idea that people need to know about this, and that this is why you write about these things.
But also, you know, I think, you know, in closing, it's such a great subject. I mean, it's so much fun to write about this stuff and to talk to people about this stuff, and people are enthusiastic and they get engaged so easily, because I think people secretly think about this stuff all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, we all go to the toilet, we all sit in the bathroom thinking something. Right?
They feel inhibited about talking about it, but they certainly do.
Scott's experience says they're ready to talk about it. Yeah. They must think
about
it. They're just not allowed to talk about it.
Absolutely. This is foundationally human, right? We're mammals. We're life forms. Stuff comes in, stuff goes out. Ignore that at your peril. You have to be aware of it.
How can you not be fascinated by something that, you know, that can be a resource, it could be a poison. I mean, if you look, we probably don't have time to go into fecal transfusions, but I absolutely love fecal transfusions. Oh, my goodness. So, and, you know, it can save your life. Poop can save your life, and that's just incredible. Actually, one of my my running club mates is a microbiologist, and he told me yesterday we went running, and he said I said, well, do you do fecal transfusions in your hospital? And he said, yeah, we do, but one of my colleagues calls it a floral transfusion. That's great. life-saving bacterial flora, and I think that's interesting that procedure is now the fecal transfusion. Particularly for C. diff, is now getting more popular, and I think more surgeons and gastroenterologists and microbiologists are open to using it because it's so dramatically successful.
Right.
But anyway, you asked me about my book, and it's not about poo or floral transfusions. It's about shipping, which is might seem a bit odd, but I think. I think I'm interested in things that people don't really notice, like sewers and toilets and ships. I don't think we pay attention to shipping. I don't think
and
we pay attention to.
It's called
90% of everything, which is the proportion of trade that is transported by sea. So basically, everything in all our offices here was probably brought by a ship, but we sort of managed to ignore the workforce and we managed to ignore. The environmental emissions from ships, and we managed to ignore all sorts of issues around shipping as well. It's another big invisible industry.
Yeah. Oh, Rose, let me ask you a question because I tell people this all the time. We talk about all these problems that we have, and I always say that if we could internalize the externalities of shipping, of fuel, that if we could, you know, find a way to charge for fuel, what its environmental costs and all that kind of stuff, that the entire world economy would change. Does that sound like a fair statement to you, or am I just making shit up?
Sorry, I didn't really get it. What do you mean?
Well, that we subsidize fuel here in the United States. We pay so little for fuel, and we don't ask the people who create the fuel or the people who use the fuel to pay for the costs that it's having for the ecological costs and stuff
right,
like that.
Right, okay.
That if we started to charge for fuel what it really costs and the damage it's really doing, that the entire world economy would change and we would be...
I've lost you again.
Well, okay. We'll talk. I'll send you an email.
I think you guys will have a lot to talk about.
Yeah. Hangout number two, perhaps.
Right. Really. Rose, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Oh my gosh, this was a great discussion, and I'm really glad, and definitely when your book comes out, I'll be promoting it like crazy, because I did really enjoy The Big Necessity. I haven't read your first book, and I was really happy, because it was Mary Roach who said you had a new book coming out, and she was reading it right now.
Oh, I love Mary. I'm reading Gulp at the moment, actually. I'm just getting to the fecal transfusion chapter, and it's like it's a thriller. I'm like, oh, my God, it's nearly coming.
Well, it's very funny. Someone on Twitter pointed out that we started our hangouts with Gulp, so what comes in your mouth, and right now we're talking about what comes ending the month with what comes out of so
it's a noble subject, isn't it, Scott?
Yeah. Yes, it is. Everything. It's all this stuff. It's great.
Yeah.
Do you have a book you'd like to mention, Scott, before we...
No, I'm good. I'm doing journalism mostly right now, so I'm just thinking about my next book. So
okay,
I have nothing to say.
Which that's a big part of it, isn't it? You have to think about it. You don't want to tell everybody what you might do. And
it's a nice. I like this bit though, where you just have a bit of time to think and
figure out what's next. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
It's fun.
Absolutely. I wish somebody else would feed my kids while that was happening, so I didn't feel so concerned about, you know, making the next bit of money. So, you know, I can think a little bit more.
Buy more books, people. Buy more books.
Right.
Read more books.
Read more books.
Definitely read them. Yeah, Jeff and I are big proponents of libraries, too. So even if you can't,
you
can't purchase the book, borrow the book. Somebody has bought that book. And
so there we go.
We get paid in the UK, anyway.
Wherever it is, we say read science.
Yes.
That's right. I don't know. Where is that on mine? Over here.
Yeah, over there.
Yeah. Okay, well, it was a pleasure, guys.
Yeah. Thank you. Pleasure. Nice talking to you, Rose.
Likewise.
Very much. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Joanne.
Rose and Scott, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, Scott. Great job.
Okay. Thanks. And,
well, I'll definitely be in touch.
Yeah, I'll talk to you real soon.
Okay.
Okay.
See you on Facebook.
See you. See you, Jeff. Bye-bye.
And I think we'll just quickly say what we've got lined up next. Who's next? Susie Esterhaus is a fabulous wildlife photographer, and she's written a series of children's books. So we're not afraid to approach anything that has to do with science or nature, whether it's for kids or adults or whatever. Susie's written some wonderful little books that she's lined up for May 31st, right?
Yes, that's right. And then looking ahead, we have Lucy Cook in June, so we'll talk more about
she
that.
She also has a kid's book. Now, she hasn't written a whole series. She's written one. It's a little book of sloth. Of course, I'm sort of crazy about sloths, but she's a filmmaker who's right. written a book about that. So she's and on a separate day. And then June 12th, big exciting news, we will have Buzz Aldrin on our show. So we are very excited about his new book, Mission to Mars. And I was reading that on the airplane the other day, and it's just really good. I can't wait to talk about it with him.
And those are only the ones that are definitely scheduled. There are more interesting authors with more interesting ideas waiting over here yet to come on, but we'll get to them as the summer goes on. It'll be very exciting.
That's right. We just need to schedule them and, you know, get things firmed up. And then also, if you guys have suggestions for us, please do. I think we will never run out of topics or authors to speak with about these. So, all right. So I guess we should sign off. Jeff, thank you. Always a pleasure.
Thanks, Joanne. We'll do it again.
Okay. See you soon. All right. Bye, everybody. Read science.